Well, good morning. We're going to spend, by way of our text, looking at three passages of scriptures from the New Testament, from the Gospels. So let's start with Matthew chapter 24 this morning. We're going to bring another installment in this mini-series, within a mini-series, on sun, moon, and stars, on the proper usage, and the proper understanding of that usage. So we're going to look at the Olivet Discourse, or a portion of that prophecy uttered by Jesus on the top of the Mount of Olives following his departure from the temple, which followed his cleansing of that temple, as it's recorded in Matthew 23. That was his second cleansing of the temple. The first one is recorded in John chapter 2, and the second and the final one recorded in Matthew chapter 23. But for this morning's text, look at verses 29 to 30 of Matthew 24. Immediately after the tribulation of those days. So notice the timing. Okay, you got this tribulation going on. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Not the literal Jesus with his feet hanging out of a cloud for all to see, but it says the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Then shall all the tribes of the earth, or the tribes of the land, which is a phrase referring to the 12 tribes of Israel, thus the nation of Israel, are going to mourn. And they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, the ending of that verse 30, the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, is the same phrase found in the last two verses of Matthew 16, and is the same verbiage that Jesus answers the high priest when Jesus was on trial, and the high priest looks at Jesus and says, "I adjure thee, are you the Christ?" And in that moment, Christ had to speak, because he was put on the spot, if you will. Up until that time, the Lamb of God remained silent. He remained dumb, if you will, before his killers. But on this occasion, when the high priest demanded an answer and called heaven into the picture, Jesus had to respond. And how did Jesus respond to the high priest? He quotes Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 to 14, where the Son of Man is ascending up to the Ancient of Days to receive a kingdom. And upon hearing those words, the high priest rent his garments and accuses Christ of blasphemy, for now Christ made himself equal with God. And in the minds and in the hearing of the Sanhedrin, that was enough to accuse him of blasphemy, and thus worthy in their eyes to be killed. Okay? But notice in verse 29, Jesus uses this language of sun, moon, and stars being darkened, turning to blood, and stars falling out of the sky, and the very heavens being shaken. Are we to understand this in a fast, wooden, strict literalism and come up with some real off-the-wall conclusions? Or is there another way, a more biblical way, to handle our understanding of the language that Jesus uses in verse 29? Okay? Now turn to Mark's account, 13. Mark's account, his account of the Olivet Discourse. Pretty sure that he got this from Peter. Peter was there, and there's a good possibility that Mark was not one of the original hearers of the Olivet Discourse. So this would have been communicated to Mark by the Apostle Peter. Look at verse 24. But in those days, after the tribulation, so now we have confirmation that whatever Jesus is talking about is going to come after the days of tribulation. The sun shall be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, the stars of heaven shall fall, and the powers that are in heaven, notice that little addition, the powers that are in heaven. So we're talking about entities here. We're talking beyond objects in the sky that you can literally see and feel the warmth, or to see the beauty of a full moon, or the beauty of the Milky Way from one horizon to the other shall be shaken. Then shall they see the Son of Man coming in the cloud with great power and glory. And then shall he send his angels, and shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from the uttermost part of the earth to the uttermost part of heaven. Well, beloved, if this is supposed to be the rapture, then you got the rapture occurring during the days of tribulation. Now, let's be consistent and honest in our interpretation. Verse 27, if you see that to be the rapture, which it's not, but if you insist verse 27 is talking about the rapture, then you got the church going through the tribulation, not being snatched away in a secret rescue mission on the part of an angel blowing a trumpet. And then Luke 21 and verses 25 and following. Luke 21. Now again, Luke wasn't there on the Mount of Olives when this was originally given. And since we know based on Luke chapter 1 and Acts chapter 1 that Luke was a good journalist in the sense that he hunted down the eyewitnesses who heard and saw, who touched and who ate and who lived side by side with the Master. Luke was a good journalist, not like the ones we have today who manufacture the history. Luke went out of his way to talk to those individuals who were part and parcel of Jesus' public ministry from its very beginning to his ascension to the Father's right hand. Look at verse 25. There shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars and upon the earth. Now notice that this is only found in Luke's gospel, what I'm about to read. Distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. So are we talking about tsunamis hitting the coast, the Mediterranean coast that borders Israel? There's going to be typhoons and hurricanes, or nor'easters batting the coast there, the eastern coast of the Mediterranean coastline? Or maybe the sea and the waves roaring is a picture that's quite often used in the Old Testament to denote the turmoil and the restlessness of the Gentile nations and powers. Men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. For the powers of heaven shall be shaken. Three times we're told the powers of heaven, the powers, are going to be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up, notice whose heads? Your heads. Why? For your redemption draweth nigh. Notice the pronoun in verse 28. Those pronouns refer to the individuals who originally heard him on top of the Mount of Olives. Not to a Jewish audience living in Palestine today, nor a future audience or a future group of Israelites living in the so-called Holy Land, centuries even from our point of reference in time. Apparently what Jesus here is describing are going to be events that they will experience, listen carefully, within their generation, within their time frame. Question one, when Jesus uttered these words in our text, did Jesus simply pull these words out of the clear blue sky? Question two, did Jesus at that time make up these words for the very first time in order to confuse his audience? Question three, when his disciples, who asked several questions which ultimately led to the Olivet Discourse, when they heard these words, referring to sun, moon, and stars, did they have any point of reference to aid them in their understanding of Jesus' usage of these words? I'm just asking very simple questions which the average churchgoer today, who listens to preacher so-and-so and doctor such-and-such and doctor so-and-so on the internet or on the television, or who reads their latest book of their jet tour of the book of the Revelation, never ask, never dare to ask, never even think to ask these questions, because I think these questions demand an honest response. Question four, in Revelation 6, let's turn there, Revelation chapter 6, this is John's Olivet Discourse. Since you don't find one in the Gospel of John, I believe Revelation is nothing more but John's expanded commentary to the Olivet Discourse. Look at Revelation chapter 6 and listen carefully as I read in your hearing verses 12 to 14. And I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell onto the earth. Now notice, stars plural, falling to the earth. And if we are to take this literally, in a strict wooden literalism, we have to include not only our yellow star in the heavens, but other stars, those big gas giants that's out there, are somehow going to be able to travel through all of that space and time and come to the earth and fall to the earth, and yet with no damage, to the point where 7 years of tribulation are still going to be going on while the earth is being bombarded by gas giants. That's how it's interpreted. And I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell onto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind, and the heavens departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. So Greenland's going to go, Iceland's going to go, Australia's going to go, Madagascar's going to go, all of the islands in the Alaskan Aleutian chain, they're going to be gone. All of the islands out there in the Southwest Pacific, all gone. Bye-bye Hawaii. Are we to understand it in that way? Because if you're going to take sun, moon, and stars in verses 12 literally, then we got to also take literally verses 14. Well, beloved, here's something for you. Is not a continent nothing but a huge island? One large landmass covered by water on all sides? Is not North America, Central America, and South America surrounded by ocean? One huge landmass, in essence, one huge island? Well, if everything is going to be moved out of place, all that's going to be left is a ball of water. So much for 7 years of tribulation. Well, in Revelation chapter 6, 12 to 14, did the congregations in Asia, those seven churches, understand John's words, those words that he employed here, or were they totally in the dark because they lacked the Scofield Reference Bible, Hal Lindsey's book, the Left Behind series, and the movie series, and John Hagee's The Four Blood Moons? I'm asking a very serious question. when the seven churches of Asia Minor, which were seven independent local congregations separated by a little bit of geographical landmass, though they were clustered quite close together, you did have to travel a few miles to get from one church or one city with that church to the other city with that church intact in that city. Then those congregations, when they heard John, when they heard these words read by their pastor for the very first time, did they have a point of reference like the apostles who heard the Olivet Discourse for the first time? Did they have any point of reference to understand the imagery that is given here? Or were they basically up a river in a boat and without a paddle? They had no sail, no compass, no rudder. They were in a boat in the midst of a river, and they didn't know which way to go because they had no compass to guide them, because they didn't have a Scofield Reference Bible. They did not have Hal Lindsey's book, The Late Great Planet Earth. They were up a river without a paddle because they didn't have the Left Behind books in the series or the movie series to watch on their iPhone, and they didn't have Pastor Hagee's The Four Blood Moons, let alone John MacArthur's Jet Tour of the Book of Revelation. Are you willing to go that far and to reach what I believe to be some of the most ridiculous conclusions under the sun? I'm just asking these questions. I'm throwing these questions on the table to either stir up your mind, aggravate you enough, rattle your cage enough to get into the Bible and go beyond what you hear on the internet. I fully and dogmatically contend that Jesus' disciples, when Jesus uttered those words that we just got done reading, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, and John 6, and the members of the seven churches of Asia fully understood Jesus. They fully understood what he meant and what he was implying. Why? They had an ancient inspired source to guide them. And that ancient source is none other than the Old Testament scriptures. I dogmatically contend and throw my flag on that answer, on that response to my questions. They knew exactly what he was saying. They understood the imagery, the genre, the type of literature, the type of wording he was using, because, beloved, they had a point of reference in the Old Testament, listen carefully, to guide their understanding. They didn't need the Scofield Reference Bible. They did not need Hal Lindsey's book, The Late Great Planet Earth. They did not need John Walvoord's book on prophecy. They did not need the latest sermons coming out of Thallus Theological Seminary. They did not need a jet tour of the Book of Revelation. They possessed the Book of Revelation, and they understood the imagery that was in there. Remember, such language used by Jesus falls under the category of apocalyptic prophetic verbiage, a very unique style of literature that was quite popular in the days of Jesus. Matter of fact, that style of literature was greatly used in that part of the ancient world several centuries before Christ and after Christ. Apocalyptic literature. How would you describe apocalyptic language? I'm glad you asked. Let me give you a few hints to kind of broaden your understanding. Number one, it's highly symbolic. Apocalyptic prophetic literature, that style, that genre of literature, which is all by itself, it stands uniquely by itself, is highly symbolic. Therefore, a literal wooden interpretation pressed upon these images and these visions and these signs and wonders is out of the picture. For instance, in Revelation chapter 1, Jesus is seen by the Apostle John as holding in his hand seven stars. Well, was Jesus holding in his hands seven gas giants that you see in the heavens in his hands? Well, within a few lines, we're told that the seven stars that were in his hands represents the seven pastors or the seven messengers who were to read their letter received by John to the pastor of that church to be read to the congregation. When it talks about Jesus having a two-edged sword dangling out of his mouth, did John see Jesus sitting on the throne looking like a grotesque monster with a sword dangling out of his mouth? Well, Paul tells us that the sword represents the Word of God. The Word of God. So one thing about apocalyptic prophetic genre is it's highly symbolic. Next, it's highly figurative. And it must be handled with care and caution on how you would interpret and come to a biblical conclusion. Not a scholarly conclusion, but a biblical conclusion. Third, and very important, it's highly dramatic. Highly dramatic. It is full of hyperbole. You have intense pictures. You have devastating judgments and consequences being pictured. I'll say it again. It's highly dramatic. It's full of hyperbole. You have intense pictures or an intense drama unfolding. You have scenes of devastating judgment and consequences coming upon the earth or coming upon a people. And then finally, on trying to describe to you this type of language, it therefore pictures the total downfall and the collapse of things which were seen as firm, stable, and indestructible. It therefore pictures the total downfall and the total collapse of things which were seen as firm, stable, and indestructible. Now, why do I say that? Because when they left the temple in Matthew 23 and went up to the Mount of Olives, and now they were able to look to the west, and before the eyes of all of them, to include Jesus, was this beautiful temple, the second temple, adorned and decorated and then renovated by Herod the Great over some 40-some years of decorating. And if my reading is correct, get this. By the time the Romans came in to destroy the temple, the last bits of that renovation had just been completed. Beautiful building. And when the disciples point that building out to Jesus, what was his response? You see that beautiful building? It's all going to come down. And because of Jesus' words, listen carefully, in its context, that generated the disciples' questions, because in their eyes and in their ears, they heard something which in their minds was inconceivable. That such a building, firmly rooted, firmly planted on terra firma, on the earth, stone so wonderfully put together, you couldn't even put a piece of paper between the seams of those blocks weighing tons upon tons of white marble. And so when you use apocalyptic language, as Jesus does in the Olivet Discourse, and as John does throughout the entire book of the Revelation, you have a unique style of literature only used in order to picture the total collapse, the total downfall of things which in the eyes of the average guy in the street are firm, stable, and indestructible. And that's why you find Jesus and John and the apostles who wrote the Gospels and such using, "and the powers of heaven shall be shaken." You have the imagery there in Revelation chapter 6 of the mountains being moved out of place. And in Luke's account, only found in Luke chapter 21, this description, and we're going to study that further down the road, this description of the hearts of men and great perplexity and great panic. What do you find in Revelation 17 and 18 when Babylon the Great is fallen? The merchants standing off to the side, seeing the city rising in smoke and flames, wailing and mourning with perplexity and shock. Because that great city thought that it would stand forever and would never be brought down again. Beloved, Jesus' words about the second temple and the shocking response by the disciples are part and parcel. The disciples in their mind thought this building could never and would never ever come down to the ground, but it did. Well, last week we looked at one idea I brought to the table from the book, I think, of Deuteronomy. Well, this morning we're going to present the second point of reference. Turn with me to Isaiah 13. We are now going to go finally to the Old Testament, and I'm going to show you the point of references that the apostles and those in the seven churches had at their disposal, whereby they had a better guide and a better key to unlock the usage of such metaphorical language as the sun being darkened, the moon turning to blood or turning to sackcloth, and the stars of heaven falling to the earth. Are you ready? Isaiah 13, verse 1. We're going to first catch the context. The burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos did see. Now, stop. This has nothing to do with Israel, number one. Number two, the prophecy that we're going to study here this morning, I'm going to lay it on the table, and then you can do whatever you want to with it. We're talking about Babylon. Babylon. And guess what? Babylon was not even a world power at this time. It's going to be about 100 and some odd years still yet. Matter of fact, at this time, the 10 northern tribes were still intact, and tiny Benjamin and tiny Judah were still intact. Isaiah prophesied before and during the exile of the 10 northern tribes, while tiny Benjamin and Judah to the south would still be intact for almost another 100 years before the Babylonians came knocking on their door, not once, not twice, but 3 times. So this is a prophecy anticipating way down the road Babylon's fall, which eventually did occur at the hands of the Persians. Now, keep on reading. Go all the way down to verse 6. The context is whom? Not Israel, but the fall of Babylon. Howl ye. And you may want to underline, for the day of the Lord is at hand. We see two phrases which in most prophetic conferences are pulled out of context and automatically labeled as referring to the second coming of Jesus. But the context here is not the second coming of Christ. This has nothing to do with the Babylon that is found in the book of the Revelation, but is ancient Babylon that will eventually be a key player in the life of God's people when you read such books as Daniel and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Notice also, is at hand. Another phrase which is normally twisted and expanded like a rubber band to include eons and eons of time. It shall come as a destruction from the Almighty. Now, when you read verses 1 and you read all the way through here, we're dealing with with Babylon, and it has nothing to do with God destroying Israel, but it has everything to do with God destroying an enemy that will be used by God to discipline his idolatrous people down the road. Therefore shall all hands be faint. Remember Luke's verbiage? Men's hearts failing, perplexity, the waves roaring, no peace, knees trembling, the hearts of men, what? Burden with anxiety, and every man's heart shall melt. Now, are we to take that literally? Everyone's going to have cardiac arrest? Or are we talking about the gut feeling of those who are going to experience this apocalyptic judgment upon Babylon? And they shall be afraid. Pains and sorrow shall take hold of them. They shall be in pain as a woman that travaileth. They shall be amazed one at another. Their faces shall be as flames. So are they going to become automatically a flamethrower? Are all these people simply going to just simply combust and become human candles? Am I to understand this in a strict wooden literalism? Or is this a style or a form of apocalyptic language that shows the intensity, the drama, the pain? Behold, the day of the Lord cometh. Verse 9 goes back to verse what? 6. This has nothing to do with the second coming of Christ. This, in its context, happens to refer to none other than God's destruction upon Babylon by the hands of the Persians, which would be eventually fulfilled in Daniel chapter 5. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, cruel, bold with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. He shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. Bada boom, bada bang. Look at verse 10. So, to answer one of my questions at the beginning of this lesson, Jesus did not draw his words out of the clear blue sky. Jesus did not go to the Sanhedrin and the Pharisees and the scribes to get their ideas on the subject. Notice in verses 10 is the same verbiage you find in the Olivet Discourse, and the same verbiage that you will find in the book of the Revelation. And therefore, I submit to you this morning, my dear friends, without reading anybody else's commentary, we have the commentary of the Old Testament here provided. Notice, smack dab in all of this destruction upon Babylon, God brings up in verses 10 the apocalyptic imagery of total lights out, total destruction, the very heavens and the earth being shaken. And notice in verses 7 and 8, the impact on those who would experience it. No different than Luke's account when the city of Jerusalem would be destroyed, the walls and the temple desecrated and brought down to the ground. We see this portrayed in Revelation 17 and 18 by the merchants who see this darling city totally destroyed as they wail and mourn. We'll keep reading. And I will punish the world for their evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. And I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease, and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. Notice in verse 11 this impact upon those who are going to go through it. I will make a man more precious than fine gold, even a man than the gold wedge of Ophir. Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall be removed out of her place. Well, if that's to be taken literally, why is the earth still here? When in Daniel 5, in the year 539 BC, Babylon was destroyed by the Persians. This is apocalyptic language. This is this unique genre of literature that is used to describe total lights out. In the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in the day of his fierce anger. Now, if you don't believe me, drop down to verse 19. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' excellency, shall be as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Case closed. We're not talking about a modern day Babylon that's going to be raised up out of the desert, as Saddam Hussein thought that he was going to be able to reconstruct and bring back into being. He's dead, and the refurbishing of ancient Babylon still lies out there in the desert, untouched by contractors. Now, look at that verse 7 and 8. Therefore all the hands shall be faint, every man's heart shall melt, and they shall be afraid, pains and sorrow shall take hold of them. And they shall be in pain as a woman that travaileth, they shall be amazed one at another, their faces shall be as flames. Now take this and turn quickly to Luke 21. I want you to compare. Again, you derive your interpretation not by reading someone's book, not by a jet tour, and not by the four blood moons, not by Hal Lindsey, let alone Scofield's notes. If you go by Scofield's notes, you will dabble in heresy. Luke 21, look at verse 25. There shall be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. Now notice verse 26 in light of Isaiah 13. Men's hearts failing them for fear, and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. You see the same imagery? You see the same response by those who would unfortunately experience the day of the Lord when Babylon would be destroyed? Now watch this. Go to Leviticus 26. Now, I'm showing you the Old Testament commentary to Jesus' usage of sun, moon, and stars. Jesus' and the apostles' usage of the heavens and the earth being shaken, and the islands being moved out of place, and men's hearts with fear and great perplexity. Look at verse 34. Then shall the land enjoy her Sabbaths as long as it lieth desolate, and ye shall be in your enemy's land. Even then shall the land rest and enjoy her Sabbaths. And we find out that the 70 years of captivity that was brought upon God's ancient people was due to the fact that they disobeyed giving the land her Sabbath rest. And what did God tell Israel? I'm going to get my rest back. And he laid the land fallow for 70 years. Watch. As long as it lieth desolate, it shall rest, because it did not rest in your Sabbaths when ye dwelt upon it. And upon them that are left alive of you, I will send a faintness in their hearts, in the lands of their enemies, and the sound of a shaking leaf shall chase them. They shall flee as fleeing from a sword, and they shall fall when none pursue it, and they shall fall one upon another as it were before a sword when none pursueth, and ye shall have no power to stand before your enemies, and ye shall perish among the heathen, and the land of your enemies shall eat you up, and they that are left of you shall pine away in their iniquity in their enemies' lands, and also in the iniquities of their fathers shall they pine away with them. Do you see the same distress found here? Beloved, I'm just showing you where Jesus got his information where Jesus found this imagery. And when the seven churches heard these words, when the book of the Revelation, when their particular letter was read to them, they didn't sit there biting their nails saying, "No comprende, preacher." They understood the signs and the imagery of the Old Testament. I'm presenting my second point of reference. And there's more. We're going to look at more of these. Well, let me finish. Let me finish. I got to close. Now note the flow of the context. As Isaiah, under divine guidance, future expands this devastation collapse of the Babylonians when the Persians and the Medes would finally come. You find that in Isaiah 13, verses 9 to 13. Many would pluck up these words and cast them either for our own days or years yet to come. But the flow of the words only point to ancient Babylon's fall. In Isaiah 13, 9, the day of the Lord, particular judgment upon a particular empire. Verses 10 of Isaiah 13. Notice how devastating the picture is being presented. In Daniel chapter 2, King Nebuchadnezzar saw himself as invincible. His grandson, Belshazzar, in Daniel 5, felt so secure within those fabulous thick defensive walls, only to be brought down in one night. Again, Nebuchadnezzar and those in their day thought that the city of Babylon, with its double-walled barrier of defense, was impregnable and defensible. And yet, in one night, the Persians slipped in very stealthily and took the city in one blooming night. Total lights out. I submit, therefore, in conclusion, dogmatically, that it's here where Jesus borrowed similar apocalyptic verbiage to describe Jerusalem's ultimate fall in 70 AD, the Olivet Discourse and the Book of the Revelation. And it had nothing to do with me presenting to you a literal interpretation, but a sobering, devastating fall portrayed as if the very heavenly cosmos itself was imploding on itself. You cannot take sun, moon, and stars in a strict literal interpretation. To do so would lead you into folly. I have presented my second point of reference to show that when Jesus used such language in the Olivet Discourse, and what is found in the book of the Revelation is language known and understood by that audience because of a point of references found in the Old Testament when God used similar verbiage to depict the destruction of nations and things and entities in the minds of men as being seen as indestructible and would never fall and never go away. Well, may God choose to bless us well.